good afternoon from Tom Reed's Hockey City Pub in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four. I'm Ed Trefsker with Derek Schooley and Jim Connolly. And, wow, championship day. I know you're ready. Looking forward to it.
Hey, we're last show, the regular season / playoffs.
Yeah.
Then we'll have a wrap-up, and then we'll get after the next season.
We will. Your contract's renewed, I heard.
Yeah, we talked about it yesterday. I went in the portal, and I'm out. And
yeah, that's good.
You, hey, hats off. We talked at the end about Jimmy's party last night. Who's who of college hockey here last night?
Absolutely.
Top party you've ever thrown, I think.
Probably. It was great to see all of the commissioners there.
Coaches.
Most of the committee, a ton of coaches, the greatest, some of the greatest journalists and broadcasters of the game.
Referees.
Yeah, it was a fantastic night. Thanks to all that were able to come down and share a drink with us and have a good time.
Also, some of the folks from places like the Humanitarian Award and the Hobie Baker Committee, good to see them out and about. We need some matching sport coats like the Hobie folks have.
No, that's okay. I'm fine.
You're okay with that.
I have a different sense of style.
Can you imagine us wearing the same sport coat?
No.
It'd be like
getting it resized every year.
ABC's Monday Night Football or something in those gold jackets.
We had lunch with Sean Hogan from College Hockey Inc. yesterday, and me and Greg Powers and his wife and Sean Hogan, and we were like, "Hey, that's an awesome jacket. Where'd you get that jacket?" It was like Fast Times Ridgemont High. And he goes, "That's a great coat." And Sean was like, "Yeah, I thought it was good too." And then I saw Bobby Gregorio had the same one on. He goes, "I thought my style kind of went down."
Well, anyway, it was good to catch up with everybody. It really, you know, it's such a small community around D1 college hockey that it in a way, it's sort of like a reunion every year at the Frozen Four. There are a lot of people you see once a year, maybe once in a while outside of that, but you get everybody in one place. And certainly being in St. Paul, even though the Gophers are not in the tournament, all the writers, there are clusters of writers in about three places around the country, and this is one of them.
Yeah,
you know,
certainly.
Our friends from the Rink Live, it was good to see a number of them out here, too.
Yeah, and, you know, people that have been around this game for a long time, you know, you guys are obviously in that boat. You know, guys like Jess Myers from the Rink Live, they all remember the days of John Barkin, who was a legendary sports information director, you know, turned to an NHL communications chief down with the Atlanta, what was that, the
Thrashers?
The Atlanta Thrashers. Before, tragically, passing away at an early age. So we always just kind of try to keep the tradition of John Barkin alive, and I think that's something I know Jess Myers, every time he walks into our event on Friday night, comes over and says, "This one's for John," you know, and it really is. That's the root of the social makeup of every Frozen Four. It all goes back to John Barkin.
Well, it's also you get to see people you haven't seen in a while. Brian Deutsch was here.
Yeah.
Brian was our sports information director for a year. Then he came here and worked for the Gophers.
Yeah.
So Brian now got out of the business. He's got a private sector job, but Brian came last night. So it's just renewing friendships, guys, people you haven't seen for a while, guys and girls you haven't seen. Like you said, the commissioners, coaches, referees, I mean, broadcast journalism, Puchegras, Colby Cohen.
Yeah, Colby, Dave Starman.
Colby was telling a story about when we beat him, Robert Morris beat him in the Anchorage tournament.
Wow.
how they had to exercise the demons, and next year they won the national championship. I mean, it was a great night.
Well, it's going to be a great night tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about tonight's championship game between BC and Denver. We'll have Andrew Mahoney from the Boston Globe joining us again at the end of this. But we're also going to be joined by some people who are movers and shakers around college hockey. We'll have Jeff Schulman, who is the Vermont Athletic Director and also the chairman of the Men's D1 Ice Hockey Committee. Jeff Fulton, Eric Martinson, talking rules and officiating. Also have Atlantic Hockey Commissioner Michelle Morgan will join us to talk. Sadie Lundquist, who recently was chosen as the women's director for college hockey, and it'll be interesting to hear about that. You know, I know you you have a close and personal connection to women's college hockey, Derek, and I've been following it a lot more closely the last couple of years as I've had opportunities to broadcast, and it's really an entertaining sport played at a very high level.
Yeah, it is, and it's growing leaps and bounds, and there are more girls, women playing than ever, and college hockey is growing, and next year you'll have another new team starting to recruit and play the following year in the CHA in Delaware, and I think the plan is just to continue growing the game. So it's not just men's college hockey growing, it's women's college hockey, and it'll be interesting to hear from her. I have never met her, but I gave Jason and Sean trouble that he got bumped this year. Both of them got bumped.
That's true.
So they got bumped, and they've long-time guests. This will be first-time callers for them.
Yes, exactly. No, I had a chance to meet Sadie in Boston during the men's Beanpot back in February. She's actually the person who gave us a connection here to the new manager of Tom Reed. She was very familiar with the place, being from the Twin Cities. And everything that I have heard about her job and what she is doing, right, you know, hitting the ground running to do everything possible to promote that women's game. Very similar to what Mike Snee does so well on the men's side. Now she's taking on that role on the women's side.
I will say this, Ed, you did send me one of the best pictures of the women's hockey this year from RIT. It was a sign that the corner crew held up towards my daughter. And it said, "Hey, number 10, which is my daughter's number, your team is better than your dad's team." So Ed got a picture of it and sent it to me because obviously we were out playing, and you always get a good chuckle with some of those things.
Well, at least they were very nice about it. They do behave better for the women's games than they do for the men's games.
It could have been
worse. A little bit more polite.
It could have been worse. My daughter said it. He thought it could have been something like, "Hey, you're on the team because your dad's the coach of the men's team," or something like that. At least they were more polite.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to talking about that. But we talked about the awards a bit yesterday, but yesterday was also a day, Jim, and I know you were covering quite a bit of this for USCHO, a day where Jerry York used to talk about that being the best practice of the year, that Friday morning practice. NBC kept that tradition going for Denver. They chose to rest most of the team after the overtime game the day before, but it was also a chance to talk to the coaches and some of the players. Anything jump out at you from those conversations yesterday?
For BC, and I guess people had said this, I wasn't at the Wednesday Boston College press conference. I had seen Denver's. I wasn't there for BC. But I was surprised by how loose everybody felt yesterday. I guess maybe you get that first game of the Frozen Four off your back, you survive, you advance, and that loosens you up maybe a tiny bit. Tough to tell, but it did feel like they were a little bit more relaxed. Denver, interestingly, you know, you mentioned that they did not practice. David Carl also did not bring any of his active players over. He practiced... What they did was just a small skate of players that were scratched on Thursday. So those are the players that also represented their team at the podium yesterday. So you end up with a backup goaltender. You ended up with a player who had not played a game all year and a guy that had played five games all year. So it was a little interesting. You don't usually see that on a Friday at the Frozen Four. But, you know, David Carl, I don't think is your typical coach. You know,
no.
When I think about things. And I didn't mind the fact. I think some people were offended by it. Some media people. I didn't mind it. I get it. Your team played a long, tough, hard overtime game the night before. You want them to rest.
They did make some media availabilities, have some of those open later in the day, which I don't know if that came from complaints, but if you were, say you were traveling from Colorado to cover the team and do your job and then you didn't have access, that kind of made it a difficult situation. So I think they found a way to accommodate it there.
You have to. I mean, you have to give some access. That's just reality. I think, you know, they know what they're doing. They've been here.
Yep.
Two years ago, they're in this exact spot.
Yep.
So they know what they're going through. And I think that David Carl is managing his players very well. This is a tough stage. You do a lot of media obligations at a Frozen Four. People don't understand that you know, you're talking about you come in on, you know, Monday or Tuesday if you're a team. On Wednesday, each coach and four players have to sit down first with Westwood One, then with ESPN. These are 30-minute interviews each. Then they have to bring that same coach and three players up in front of the media for 30 minutes. That's 90 minutes alone of just media obligations. Forget about the fact that you had to practice, too, and get used to the ice and all that stuff. People really don't understand how much these players get put through at a Frozen Four. It's not like anything you do all year.
That was the hardest thing that we had when we got our first time to the our only time to the tournament is coming to the rink and media availability and sitting around and waiting.
Yep.
And it's fun, it's exciting, but it's also long and boring and mentally challenging, and going in and meeting with all the people, and it felt like after a while it's like, can we just get to playing?
I mean, that's a fact, and I think that's why usually you see the teams come in a little looser on Friday, because they've gotten through probably the hardest part of their week, which is Wednesday and Thursday.
You know, and that really has a lot to do with why you have that 10, 11 days between the regionals and the Frozen Four. And I know this year I was broadcasting at a regional, and to go from Sunday night when the brackets were announced to getting on the road on Tuesday and making all the arrangements and everything, that's a lot to pull together for a team. And if you finish your regionals on a Sunday and then would have to go to the Frozen Four on Monday or Tuesday, that's just too fast to turn around. You really need that time that's in there.
I think about it. It happened for a long time. I'm going back to my days in college hockey. 94, I remember being with Lowell, and we were in the West Regional in Lansing, Michigan. We finished our game somewhere around 8 o'clock on Sunday night. We lost in double overtime to Minnesota. But if we had won, we would have advanced to, I can't even remember where the 94 Frozen Four was, but we were not going home. But we didn't know that when we left Lowell 4 days earlier. It was told, you know, right before the game, hey, we're getting on a plane and going if that's it. Now, I remember saying, geez, I don't even have clothes. I didn't pack for this. I mean, I do like the fact that you have this off week. And I've heard rumblings. I don't think it's that feasible anymore to go back to that format, but I've heard rumblings that some people, because the season is so long, want to move it up a week and get that Frozen Four. You know, it would align with the same week as the men's and women's basketball tournament. That's why I don't think we'll ever see it. Ratings, obviously. And the NCAA only has so much staff.
Right.
To put around to championships. You don't want to have three of your bigger ones all on the same weekend.
Right. Plus, you're talking video units and trucks and
right. All
that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
And just in my time on the committee, as like you said, staff, ratings. But also you have the stations. Where are you going to put everything? I mean, you got ESPN. You want to be on the big network.
Right, right.
So
no,
you want to be on all these networks.
Right.
And until the women's championship just got moved to ABC this year for the first time.
Right.
So there is a ESPN open, but they're all they don't want to compete with themselves.
No, they don't. No, I've heard people talk about it. I don't think it's anything that we're really going to see. Maybe we can address that with Jeff Shulman. I don't think it is something that we really expect to see in any time soon, because right now I think the season works. If anything, people have talked about pushing it further out, start the season later, push the championship even a little later. I don't think we'll see that I hear a lot, well, the Stanley Cup goes till June. I don't think we want to be playing college hockey in
yeah
in
but
May.
I mean, this is a winter sport that is all but 2 months of the school year.
The longest sport in college athletics.
Yes, it is. And that's something when you have, and I've been through three athletic directors and two interim athletic directors. And every time I get a new one, they always talk about how long our hockey season is. So I don't see anything being added. Maybe a little bit, maybe a week here or there, maybe a week extra week of practice full time, but I don't see anything being added.
No, I couldn't see it either.
Well, we're going to be joined by guests as we go along here. We're watching for our first guest to arrive here at Tom Reed Hockey City Pub.
You haven't even talked to us about our homework assignment. You gave us a homework assignment.
Oh, that's right. Well, that's part of it. I guess we could talk a little bit about that. I figured we'd get into that with when we have Andrew Mahoney, but why don't we touch on that? What I was asking is come up with a reason or reasons why each of these teams, Boston College and Denver, will win or why they won't win.
And we spent the whole morning doing it. That's all we did all morning.
Wow.
Jim had the computer out. We were researching. I was asking questions. Like we spent more time on this than we did on some of our term papers in college.
That's interesting. All I remember doing this morning was sleeping.
Oh.
Were you sleeping on your textbook and try to absorb
exactly,
it that way?
That's how we stayed in college.
That was most of the way I did my homework in college, yes.
No, I was looking across when you were on your computer. I was copying.
That's smart, too. That's smart. No, I'll give you one answer. I'll give you the why a team will. I look at Boston College. If their offense gets going, if that freshman line cannot be held at bay. And listen, that freshman line scored twice against Denver back in October and lost 4-3. I don't picture that game happening tonight, though. You never know. National title games can be interesting, but I don't picture that. I see this game being relatively tight checking. And if BC can get, you said three yesterday. I'm going to give the numbers four. If BC gets to four, they win the championship. I think three probably wins it for them as well. Now, for Denver, I think that's kind of the opposite side of that coin, is Denver has to keep BC below two. If BC gets into that 3-4 range, I don't know that Denver wants to track meet tonight. They have the offense. I get it, but that offense has not been scoring of late. Tougher opponents, tighter hockey. They're happier in a tight game.
Denver has not scored fewer than two goals in a game all season.
That's kind of crazy. That's crazy. I knew that they had never won a 2-1 game until they got to the regionals. Now they've done it three times. I did not realize that stat.
I was watching numbers in those games as part of my writing assignment, so I was looking at a lot of things like that. BU, on the other hand, scored one goal five times and lost four of those games.
Crazy.
So, yeah.
That's crazy.
I would say one of the reasons that I think I talked about this on our preview over there, I think we've got a team that I still think that they get to three, but I also think that you've got such good goaltending on BC's side. The advantage goes offensively to BC and in the net to BC. Where's the advantage for Denver in this game? That's my question. Where is the advantage of Denver?
I don't think they have a distinct one. That's one of the things that we'll talk about a little bit later in the show, but I think that's something you really have to think about.
We're going to take a quick break and bring on our first guest. This is USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four in St. Paul. Welcome back to USCHO Live Saturday at the 2020 Frozen 2024. I said
you still want to take us back in time, don't you?
But there wasn't
the one
that year.
The Frozen Four that didn't exist.
In Detroit, yeah, must be
I got
thinking
the best.
Of that.
I still got the best right now.
Yeah, in St. Paul, I met Trevsker alongside Jim Connolly and Derek Schooley. And Jim, let's bring in our first guest.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to welcome in the Director of Athletics from the University of Vermont, a good hockey guy right here, and also the chair of the men's NCAA Division I Ice Hockey Committee. That's Jeff Shulman. Welcome. What a fantastic weather day. You brought the great weather from Tampa from last year. That's fine. I don't mind that at all. But we're in the Twin Cities. It's a great atmosphere.
I know. You can always count on St. Paul and the Twin Cities to show NCAA hockey fans a good time. Extra special when they turn up the 80-degree weather in the middle of April. So coming from Vermont and the Northeast, like all of us here, it's great to have such a sunny day for such a special event.
This is your fourth year on the committee?
Fourth year on the committee,
Last year?
Last year, yeah.
So take us through the highlights of, obviously it's been a little bit, you dealt with the COVID, right? Dealt with cancellation of the championship. Take us through your term here and highlights, and obviously I went through the lowlights there,
yeah.
The challenges. Take us through a little bit of your term here on the committee.
Yeah, well, it's fun to get to work with you on the committee for over like a month or two, right?
Yeah, it should have been a 2 years, but
okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were
together. We'll forget about why that happened.
My first year on the committee was 2021 when the Frozen Four was in Pittsburgh, and that was the year that just college hockey and the rest of college athletics.
Oh, we had a full year then.
What?
We had a full
year.
Yeah.
You were on that?
Yeah, I had 1 year there.
You were on the committee
when
we went to Pittsburgh, right? So, that was so unique because one of the exciting things about being on the hockey committee in comparison to any other committee is that you have the metric, the pairwise, of course, which is the is really the gospel as it relates to selection. So the selection pressure on the hockey committee is unlike any other committee because it doesn't really exist in the same way. But, of course, that COVID year was the 1 year in the last, I don't know how many, where we had to have a subjective process. So that made it kind of interesting. We got through the Frozen Four in Pittsburgh, and everyone was thankful that we were able to have an event. And then we went Boston, Tampa, and now here in Minneapolis. And they've all been spectacular in their own way. Three straight Frozen Four sellouts and great energy, great hockey. But it's a really enjoyable committee to be a part of. And part of it, what it is really a reflection of the broader college hockey community, which is really unique amongst college sports and college athletics. And there's a camaraderie and a kinship that exists in college hockey that I think is very special. And so to be in a leadership role in this community has been fantastic for me. Personally, I have a hockey background. I played hockey at the University of Vermont, played in the NCAA tournament as a student athlete. One of the first things I ever did professionally was I was an intern at the ECAC. Joe Bertagno was the commissioner. It was my first job out of UVM. And this was, of course, before the internet or email. And I wrote a letter to the Phil Buttafuoco, who was at the NCAA running the hockey championship, and explained him my background and asked if I could come help out at the – wasn't called the Frozen Four at the time, but it was the hockey championship in Detroit in 1990. He said, sure, come on. And I went there and I volunteered and helped out, ran stats, did whatever I could. And so now, 34 years later, whatever it is to, be the chair of the committee, sort of full circle for me career-wise and something I'm, proud of and have really enjoyed.
We obviously know next year we're headed to St. Louis. That'll be exciting, a non-traditional market, if per se, Las Vegas, a very non-traditional market. For the NCAA to head there, but then the bid process is open here, and we're hearing rumors of cities that are going to bid and all of that sort of stuff. But can you take us a little bit through the process and really what the committee looks for in the host cities for this event?
Yeah, it's multifaceted, and you're absolutely right. So we're committed next year for the Frozen Four and regionals. They're committed for the next 2 years, so 25 Frozen Four being in St. Louis, as you said, with the University of Vermont as the host.
Right.
That may
So they can't get rid of you the that easy.
So I'll be around whether people like it or not. The Blues and the St. Louis Sports Commission are really doing the heavy lifting on it. But the president of the St. Louis Blues, a guy named Chris Zimmerman, who's a Vermont alum, so we were excited to partner with him. But they're really excited. The whole city's excited. I think it's going to be a great Frozen Four. And then, of course, Vegas in 26. And then you're right. We're out for bid for 27 and 28. The bids have all come in already. It's not not public what the sites have bid, but I can tell you that, you know, we're a really good array of NHL cities, some, you know, that are be familiar to college hockey fans, and some new cities that are really interested in. The Frozen Four has an amazing reputation. NHL franchises, cities with big sports commissions really want to attract this event, and it's a credit to college hockey and the level of play, the quality of the game, and our amazing fans that turn out no matter where we go. So I'm excited for that process. We obviously work very closely with the NCAA staff to make decisions that we think ultimately are best for the game and for the sport and for our fans and student-athletes. And we've got some great choices, and we'll pick two outstanding cities to go to, and the great tradition of the Frozen Four will carry on.
Jeff, we talked on Selection Sunday about the regionals. Looking back on it now, what's your assessment of how those went? I think I know the answer because I probably agree.
Yeah, I thought it was a really another very successful year for regionals. And as a committee, and Derek certainly went through this as well, you know, the regionals are a real area of focus for the committee. I think the Frozen Four, for all the reasons you'd expect. But the Frozen Four is sort of an automatic draw, and we've got fans that travel around. But it's really important to the committee and to the NCAA that those regionals are healthy, and they really have been the last 2 years in terms of attendance, in terms of the quality of play, the quality of the facilities, the ice. These are all the things that we're concerned about, because it's obviously right next to the Frozen Four, which is the pinnacle of the game, but the regionals, the national tournament, and we want facilities, and we want an event that's befitting of that. And I thought we had four great regionals this year, Springfield and Providence, Sioux Falls, and I was actually out in Maryland Heights outside of St. Louis, and there was a lot of concern about capacity there. They ended up putting over 3,200 people in the facility. The energy was great. The teams and athletes had what they needed, and it was a great way to sort of kick off the year heading into the Frozen Four.
I think there's always debate about regionals, and there's been debate since you've been on the committee, I've been on the committee. I mean, you go back, there's always debate. Where do you see, get your crystal ball out, and I know you were asked this on the State of the Game yesterday, and there's always, everybody's got an opinion. How do you see the regionals moving forward? If you were asked as the outgoing chair, your thoughts on how things should go.
Yeah, I mean, I think like everything in college athletics, we have to constantly check ourselves and say, you know, is the status quo working? Are there ways to improve the status quo? Or do we need to look at something really, you know, transformative? And, you know, obviously I'm very aware and have been part of conversations about new formats for the regionals, including, you know, going to a high seed for a regional, going to high seeds throughout the tournament. And there's you know, smart people who care a lot about college hockey that are advocating for that. It does feel like, you know, the discussion about high seeds has ebbed and flowed over the years. It may be a little louder right now by some, and that's okay. It's healthy. These are all people who care deeply about college hockey, as we do, as members of the committee. And so we'll have these conversations in Naples and elsewhere. We're having them this weekend as well. And ultimately, we want what's best for the game. And if that means looking at different ways to approach the regional round, we'll certainly do that. But as you know, schools, the overwhelming consensus amongst coaches for many, many years has still been
neutrality.
Neutrality, although neutrality, of course, is somewhat subjective as well. The policy that we have, which is that if you host, you're going to be placed in your region. When I say host, you're the host school at a facility, wouldn't be on campus. So that, you know, that's not full neutrality, which some people point to as concerning. But obviously that does contribute to the atmosphere and the energy and the crowds at the regional. So we're trying to balance a lot of things. And I think, you know, we've got a great committee of people represent all the different conferences, coaches, administrators, people with pretty deep histories in the game, and we're going to do what we think is best.
You mentioned host institutions having to be where they're placed, and that happened twice. One of them was in Springfield, and that caused a couple of Eastern teams to be out in Sioux Falls, and I did enjoy the trip out there, so I'm not going to complain about that. But that brings up the pairwise and how things are determined for the tournament. This is another place where college hockey is unique because it's transparent and by the numbers. But there was some questioning about the numbers. So I guess two parts. Are we going to see in the near future any changes in that formula? And, you know, what's your take on whether the committee should fudge the numbers or whether we should keep by the book and transparent?
Well, I think the questions weren't necessarily that our formula was applied incorrectly. Some people may question the formula.
Right, exactly.
And say, you know, and that's a reasonable thing to ask. It's a really important thing to ask. And we're always looking at that as a committee, and we work with Tim Danahue, you know, fans of college hockey, some may know, but he's sort of the person, the guru, the math guru behind the pairwise. And we're always looking and saying, how, you know, should we tweak it? Should we weight road wins, road results more than home results, which we do slightly right now? How do we look at head-to-head comparisons? How do we look at common opponents? How does that all fit in the pairwise? So I don't think there was any questioning about whether we applied the equation
right,
properly.
Right.
The question is, what should the equation be?
Exactly.
And that's a reasonable thing to talk about, and we do talk about it all, and we do make tweaks sometimes. What's important and what the college hockey community has always really valued is that once you settle on it, that's the formula then. We're going to go by it. People know where they stand, and as you guys know, you know, you head into that last night of conference championships, and everybody knows exactly what permutations have to happen in order for their team to get in or their team to get bumped out. And so I think we're going to stick with a metric for selections. How we modify that metric, it's been modified a fair amount over the years, and I think it'll continue to be.
Have you figured out when Tim speaks, have you understood it more?
No.
We both looked at each other numerous times. I needed to pay attention more in college.
I think what I'm able to do, as a lot of people are able to do, is you look at the numbers in the end. And Tim's pretty good at explaining it, but there's definitely some math.
There were times where we would look at each other and go, what?
Right. But it also, you know, what we bring to it, what you as a coach and what others and fans bring to it is the eye test, right? So you look at the pairwise in the end and you say, you know what, that looks pretty right. Maybe you can quibble with one or two spots, but you say, you know what, this really looks like the order of teams, or at least, you know, in a more general way.
And we talked about this on our show throughout the year, and I actually got some feedback of saying from people that thought that this may be, and we just kind of threw it out there jokingly, is maybe you take the 15 teams that go by pairwise or the including AQs and give the committee the leeway to pick the last one. Because you saw, and everybody saw the graphic that ESPN put up comparing UMass and Colorado College.
Yeah.
And everybody was wondering how that happened, because Colorado College, the eye test went with Colorado College's favor on that graphics.
Yeah.
And then, but the math and everything said UMass.
Yeah.
So maybe at the end, do you give the committee a leeway?
Yeah.
Kind of a best of both worlds thing to give that last scenario. I know it'll never happen,
but it's a fun thing to think about. You know,
very cute. As a guy going off the committee, what would you think about that?
I'm happy to saddle future generations committee with that. Now, it's you know, I've had conversations with colleagues who are chairs and on other sport committees within the NCAA, and they're always so jealous of our process. But like you said, there is some excitement about the bubble and who's on the bubble. And what's the committee going to do? When you hear it a lot in men's, women's basketball and in other sports, and so that, you know, that's part of the energy of a tournament. But I think the system works well for college hockey right now.
But we did get to pick a tournament.
Yeah,
I got yelled at by the people in our league was we only took one Atlantic hockey team.
Yeah,
because we had at that time we had Army that was really good, and we had, I mean. Of course, we only had league play.
Yeah, it was so, that was such a difficult, you know, it's hard enough when it's subjective, but then throw into the mix that there was very little interconference play that year, if any, I can't even remember.
A little bit.
Yeah, and so it made it very difficult to compare across conferences. So, yeah, that was a little taste of the subjective side of it, and I'm happy that the next 3 years we're
back to
fairway.
Let's some people moving forward.
What's that?
Let's give this to somebody else moving forward.
As we talk about, you know, the great bubble and, you know, how close some teams feel like they should have been, Colorado College was a great example this year. Does the thought, as this game keeps expanding in terms of the number of teams playing it, does the tournament maybe need to expand? Do we need a play-in round like basketball has where it could be 18 instead of 16 in this tournament?
Yeah, you know, the NCAA looks at ratios for postseason field sizes, and right now we're kind of in the sweet spot for a 16-team tournament. So I think we'd probably have to expand quite a bit before we looked at a 18 or 20. I mean, it's also very neat and clean with 16 teams, four regions.
Right.
The women are at 11, so they have this awkward, like, three sites have three teams. It's an odd format. So, but having said that, the level of college hockey right now is as good as it's ever been, probably better than it's ever been, and there's parity, and you know, who knows what's going to happen with the CHL. Are there going to be more good players brought into college hockey? So, you know, I think we always have to be looking at postseason and seeing, does this fit? Should we be talking to the NCAA about expansion? And, you know, there's certainly some good teams that were left out.
Well, that's and I'll preface this because we've talked a lot about the transfer portal. We've talked a lot about major junior and the blue bloods, per se. Would that be a avenue to help expand and get new teams into the tournament, because we are, the rich are always getting richer right now with players, with all that, help expand, help get new teams in the tournament by expanding it and help that?
Yeah, it's an interesting approach. You know, I know there is a lot of conversation going on. There will continue to be a lot of conversation about how do we, you know, how do we make sure that hockey doesn't go the way of some other sports where it really becomes based on just resources, you know, and if you're a high resource school, you're going to be able to, you know, buy your way into an elite program. And some of that is inevitable and you can't change. But you know, if there's things that the national committee can do and that the NCAA can do to ensure, you know, programs that are lower resource schools, as you know, we have a lot of non-Division I schools, institutions that are playing Division I hockey. How do we continue to support those programs, making sure they can stay competitive? So, you know, different access to the national tournament may be part of that conversation.
And that's the worry with going to home sites, is that it's always going to be the same 10, 11, 12 teams for those eight home sites.
Yeah, no question. And, I don't know. It'd be an interesting, you know, there's no way to really assess it unless you actually implemented that for a few years. But I think, you know, in a single game, it's anybody, you know, anything can happen, whether you're at a neutral site or at an away site. You know, does an underdog have a slightly better chance on a neutral ice sheet than they would at going to Denver or Minnesota or Michigan or BC or BU? Probably. But you're trading, you know, that's the argument. Are you trading that off for a packed building and a college atmosphere? And so that's the discussion around high seed versus neutral site regionals.
Well, Jeff, your final night as the chair. You get to present the trophy at the end of this game. I know that's always a pride moment for this committee. You guys put on a great championship. Obviously a fantastic host city here, St. Paul. Congratulations on what has been a great tournament. Let's have one more great game tonight.
That's what we're looking forward to. Thank you guys for all your support and coverage of college hockey. And, you know, when you get in an environment like this, you just realize what a special community is. And you guys are a big part of that. So thank you.
Thanks, Jeff Schulman from UVM and the NCAA Men's D1 Ice Hockey Committee. We're going to take a break and come back with more of USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four in St. Paul. Welcome back to USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four in St. Paul. I'm Ed Trefsker along with Jim Connolly. And now, Jim, we get to talk about rules and officiating. Why don't you bring on our next guest?
This is possibly one of my favorite segments we do every year.
Yeah.
And especially this year, we'll call it a rules change year. Every 2 years, the rule book of college hockey gets to be reevaluated. So we're joined by the Secretary of Rules Editor, Jeff Fulton, and the Deputy Athletic Director from the University of North Dakota and the Chair of the Rules Committee, that is Eric Martinson. Welcome in, guys. This has been a fun tournament, but now you're a game away from really starting your process, which is a long one this summer, of thinking about what could change in rules. Just some general thoughts as we head into this, what's always an interesting off season.
Sure. I mean, the work started 2 years ago. So we started putting together the rule changes. The rule changes discussions come from fans, comes from athletic directors, comes from coaches, comes from our officials, our coordinators. So we've been gathering that for 2 years. We've got about 60 discussion points right now for rule changes. And we will meet in 2 weeks in Naples with our coaches, and we'll review those rule changes and have a discussion. We'd like to use it more as an event to be able to help us solution some of our rules, because I think we need to look at some rules that we may need some more definitive verbiage on within our rule book to help our officials.
Let me guess that goaltender interference might be on your list.
It sure is. It's right at the top, and that's what we're going to ask for, you know, for their support and to ask their thoughts on how we can better decide what's goaltender interference and what's not.
That's an interesting topic to me, and the reason being, this is not just a college hockey rule that's an issue. People in the NHL, fans all the time say, I have no idea what goalie interference is. It is a very difficult rule in general just to define, right? I mean, Eric,
yeah.
You've probably heard so much feedback on this from coaches, from officials themselves,
yeah,
that understand that this is not an easy rule to review when you get into an instant replay situation and decide, oh, yeah, that was goalie interference, that wasn't.
Yeah, I think, you know, thanks for having us on. I think this is awesome to talk about what we're doing. And as Jeff said, you know, this is a ongoing process to talk about rules throughout, and goaltender interference is a big one that we talk about all the time. And a lot of times it's hard to get consensus. You know, even you could have, you know, one clip and it's you have a room and it's split 50-50 or 60-40. You know, it's tough to get consistency, and I think that's just our job to – try to massage the rules to try to make it black and white. It's probably never going to be black and white, especially like a goaltender interference. And at the end of the day, the refs have judgment, and we have to be okay with that. Like,
yeah,
that's sport, that's athletics, that's, you know, the game of hockey, and ultimately that's why the officials are on there. And we try to, Jeff does such a great job of, we send out guidance every other week to try to get consistency so that they're seeing multiple, you know, situations like goaltender interference that they can look at and go, okay, This is how they want that to be called, or this is how they want us to look at, you know, in situations when they're under review of looking at what is goaltender interference and what isn't. And it's our job to kind of tweak some things, and we do a lot of, you know, we feed off of the NHL and feed off other things. As Jeff said, trying to make it consistent and simplify things is kind of our goal to try to go into this next rule change year to make it easier for coaches, student athletes, and officials.
You just used a word in there, judgment.
Yes.
And I think some fans forget, a rule book, rules are black and white. You either follow rules or you break them, right? But there's so much judgment that goes into officiating. Fans almost have to understand that part, that judgment means just as much to a call like goaltender interference, or what is a hook, or what is a trip. Then there's still a human element that has to be applied in officiating.
Absolutely, and I think that's what we love about sport, right?
Right?
There is a human element. If it was perfect, if everyone was perfect, if the officials were perfect, I think the what we love about sport would actually be watered down, and it wouldn't be what we love today. So I think the human element, the like we always say, you can't officiate on intent, but sometimes there is, okay, what was that person doing? So there's all the different factors that go into an official's head that we try to make it easy for them in the rules, but ultimately they have to be able to do that on the ice, and it's hard. It's very hard, but we try to do our best in trying to really clarify things within the rule book, and that's what we can do to help them out.
It is a fascinating, Jeff, you spent a lot of years as an NCAA official. The speed of the game, I think, is one thing that fans forget. And you'll watch a game, and then you'll go on to social media and you see the fans ripping the refs. The speed of the game, and it is not slowing down.
No.
The speed of the game makes that job as an official nearly, I'm not going to say impossible because they do a great job at it, but it makes it really complicated, complex.
And it does. And you know what? We've added video replay to our sport. Obviously, that's probably the biggest reason why we did that is because of the speed of the game. Contact to the head, for example. How fast can we see it? Where is a contact? With a human eye, we have trouble seeing it, you know, so we have to slow it down. We have that, but at our Division III level, we don't have that.
Right.
Right? So that speed is still there at Division III, but we don't have video replay. So it's you know, the key driver for why we went to video replay and why we keep building out our video replay.
Jeff, you mentioned video replay, and that kind of is a nice tie-in to talking about video challenges, coaches' challenges. There's been some discussion, some proposals from people. I'm sure it's something you're looking at, is whether to change it from allowing a team to challenge and then losing the timeout if they fail to going to a minor if they...
The NHL style.
The NHL style. Is that something that's on the table right now?
It certainly is, and it's going to make for an interesting conversation in Florida with our coaches, right? So we are looking to go to the NHL model. I mean, it's an option to do that. We're looking at some other alternatives when it comes to video replay, like missed game stoppages. We have certain elements of our rule that call out direct result, which means if there's, say, a missed game stoppage and there's a change of possession, then, you know, we would allow that goal to stand. I think we need to make it easier for our officials in those situations where it's consistent with the pro rule book, with the USA Hockey rule book, so we're not different than everybody else in putting that, you know, our best officials are working pro hockey. So we need to make it easier for them to do that. But to your question, we are looking at that very closely as well as some other alternatives.
As you mentioned, you know, aligning with the pro game, I actually have always liked the college change to during a delayed penalty, if you score a goal, the penalty still exists. I've always liked that, but that does not align with the NHL. And you hear fans, they get confused sometimes when they see the college game. You've actually done something pretty darn good. You've pulled your goaltender and scored a goal when you have an extra attacker,
right,
during a delayed penalty. So you shouldn't really have to lose your power play. But I keep hearing people say, I think we should go to the NHL rule and just go back to that. And now there's something that will probably be on the table here.
It is. It's one of the items that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a couple of them that the NHL we feel is inconsistent with pro hockey. And we, again, our job is to make it as simpler as we can for our officials, make it consistent, and to your point, not to confuse our fans.
I think that's one of the biggest things, you know, when you look on X or social medias or different things of fans not understanding what the actual rule is. So when something happens, we don't want to confuse the fans either. We
right.
don't need them going, why did this happen? Because a lot of our fans, they're watching other styles of hockey, and if they are used to that in the NHL, they're confused on if we get kind of too crazy outside of what that is in the college game. So I think it's unique. There are some uniqueness to it, but we also want to, you know, simplify it as well.
A few years ago, this not a rule so much as just protocol of face-offs changed, where you did not kick out a center on a face-off violation. And I've heard coaches say, it's okay, it kind of works. I've heard a linesman say it's not great because the team, once they've gotten that first warning, almost feels that they'll never get a second warning and get the minor penalty. How much of an issue is that, and how much does that maybe need to go back to align with what the NHL does?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we implemented that, I think the intent of that rule was to speed up
right.
the game. And the beauty of doing the rule change every other year, we get to look at what was changed and maybe say, okay, do we need to revert back? Do we need to massage it a little bit? Do we need to look at different ways? So I think that is a great example of one where we said, hey, our intent was to speed up the rule. We don't feel like it is speeding up the rule or speeding up the game. So how do we maybe go back to it so that those centers aren't cheating and getting a free one? You know, we talked, there's a couple, we got some feedback where the center said, hey, I'll cheat every time on that first one because if you call it, I'll maybe calm down on the second one. And if you don't call it, well, then I was able to cheat and I had an advantage. So You know, just, you know, our student athletes and coaches are really smart when it comes to finding loopholes or finding, you know, that advantage. So as we learn, you know, as we go through it, I think it's that stuff that, that we need to bring back and brought back to the committee to look at to make sure that we don't have those.
Aside from rules, I want to actually go to the game on the ice and here this weekend. Obviously, you have three crews here with you. These are, as much as everybody knows that these 16 teams fought to get here, so did these 12 officials that are here this year. Just the process maybe of how they get selected and how this is kind of like almost like an all-star game for them. They know that they're among the best in the country.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. They work hard all year to get to this point, just like the teams do. They're on the road every weekend. They're traveling every weekend. They're away from their families. It's not a full-time job for most of our NCAA officials. So,
yeah.
it's a heavy lift, but this is their reward for doing a great job during the year. And the way it works is within the leagues, they put forward their first best one or two, three crews. They get placed in the tournament. So I think if you look at the tournament, for the most part, every league had two crews in the NCAA tournament. And then from there, Frank Cole, who's the national coordinator of officials, then selects those three crews to move on to work these games this weekend.
Yeah, you can tell when I run into the officials around the city, and they're excited to be here.
Yeah,
and it's a real thrill for them, and the crew that gets the finals always seems to have that extra, you know, sense of pride in it. What are we maybe missing here? I know we can go back to the rules part of it. Are there other things that are big discussion points that we're not thinking of here?
Yeah, I think with the coaches, I mean, we talked about goaltender interference. I think hitting from behind and contact to the head is something we need to revisit. The last rule change, we went to a five-minute major only for an offensive player that put themselves in a vulnerable position, for example, or turned at the last second. We would allow, used to be five in a game misconduct or five in a DQ, so we allowed for a five. So we want to revisit that with the coaches because we obviously don't want to put our student athletes in any jeopardy of being injured. So we're going to revisit that. We're going to talk about, do we go back? Do we keep it the same? Or do we look in certain situations like we had a hit the other night that the defensive player did everything right, but there was contact with the head, right?
Right.
So there was no extension. There was no launching. There was nothing. The player made a good play, and he made contact with the head. So that's a situation we needed to discuss with our coaches and see if we want to go to either a minor penalty or no penalty in those situations.
One thing that I've wondered about, and since you're bringing it up, is the direct and indirect contact to the head. Are there situations where you could say that maybe it's indirect, but 90% of the force is still going to the head, and maybe moving, you know, up along, up, you know, glancing along the body and then making contact? I guess that falls in that judgment area. How do you handle a situation like that? How does an official approach that? That might be difficult at times.
Yeah, and it is, and thank God for replay, you know, especially at this level. But we're looking for where the initial contact on the body is. So, for example, if the initial contact on the body is in the shoulder and the chest and it rides up to make head contact, that we would consider a two-minute minor penalty. Where we're looking for that direct shot to the head, whether, you know, with a body part, a shoulder, whatever it may be, even with a stick, with some force, that's what we're looking for contact to the head on. So it's got to be directly to the head. But it's something, you know, we need to investigate.
Before I let you go, I want to go back to actually video review in general. Since the coaches' challenge came in, I guess, was that 2 years ago? Or that, two years ago when the coaches' challenge came in, it does feel like we're not dissecting a mosquito here. Like, we're not looking at everything on video review. Has that been something that you've heard positive feedback? There's less video review now than there was 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, and you know, the feedback we got nationally was we're slowing our game down with video replay. So I think that was a good way to curb that. The NHL has given us good input to going to a minor penalty, to Ed's, you know, remark earlier. I mean, personally, I like that. I'm not sure our coaches are going to agree with it, but that it leads it more strategic, right? And we would be it'd be all right to go that way if that's what they wanted.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that we have to remind, like, there's a progression with a lot of these things. Like, we talked about the check from behind and hitting check from behind and head contact. We had to get to the standalone to get to the next iteration of it. So I think there's a progression that you're going to see from last rule change year to this rule change year to set things up for going forward with contact to the head, those standalone majors, but also the coaches' challenges and those things. We had to get to a certain point to get to the next point. So those are the things that, again, we're going to massage and kind of look at to see if we can better, you know, what's best for the game.
I wish we could talk about this for the next hour. Honestly, there's so much to talk about when it comes to officiating. It's really fantastic. But Jeff Fulton, Eric Martinson, thanks for stopping by. Enjoyed a nice game, obviously. But thanks for the transparency that I think the Rules Committee officials have made for a number of years. But it's always great to get that transparency for our fans.
We appreciate it, Tim, and thanks for all you guys do here at College Hockey. It's a real benefit, and I get to watch you on TV once every weekend.
Appreciate everything, guys. You guys do a great job. Thank you.
Thanks, and we'll be back with more of USCHO Live Saturday at the 2020 Frozen Four in St. Paul in just a moment. Welcome back to USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four in St. Paul. I'm Ed Trefsker along with Jim Connolly and Derek Schooley.
I'm back.
You are back.
Yes.
We kept you out of trouble. We kept you away from that discussion.
It's a line change.
Is this the one? This is the one that I should be banned from.
Well, no. This is your opportunity to get some brownie points.
Well, let me ask the first question.
Well,
what
let's later do
here.
Oh, no. I want to dive right into this one.
Oh, no.
We are joined now by first-year Commissioner of Atlantic Hockey, Michelle Morgan. Welcome. One year now in the books.
Thank you.
Take us to season one. No, let me go.
Who is her favorite coach first?
Well, that's what you're supposed to close
with
that.
No, it's the opener.
Well, I know you're going to say Rick Gawkins.
It's the hard opener right now.
Yeah, since you're the one present sitting next to me.
Exactly.
Of course you know my answer. No, year one's been great. It's flown by. It's actually pretty special to be here in St. Paul in a championship and kind of the culmination of my first year because I spent a lot of time here in the Twin Cities. I played college hockey here at St. Thomas. Spent many years working for the Minnesota Wild, and so to kind of finish the year off, this is icing on the cake.
Going back home, it says it's going to be a nice little homecoming for you.
Exactly. Now, even better would be to have a team in it, you know, here, but that's another story, and we'll get there.
I want to start with recapping the season and maybe even the championship. You know, you had fantastic attendance at your league championship on campus sites.
That is something that's, you know, a topic between certain leagues. Certain leagues have moved to that campus site. It's working for your league, especially I looked at the crowd that was at Rochester for your championship game. That's a big win for this league.
Absolutely. I had the opportunity to be at a couple different sites throughout the playoffs. You know, what RIT does in their building and packing it is certainly something special, and they've kind of found that special sauce, if you will. Campus sites work for us right now. Does that mean it's going to be that way forever? Not necessarily. I think it's always open for a discussion, but how are we being strategic about what works right now? There's some changes that's going to be coming in the future and other leagues that have been neutral sites in the past that might be going back to campus sites. And so I think that what's most important is that experience for our teams and our student athletes to play in front of a full barn. Nobody wants to be in a place that's cavernous and empty, right? And so I think that it's the partnership between the league and the institutions and the team to make a collaborative effort in putting butts in seats.
Obviously, you came back last year. We came back last year. You came to the league. Take us through your first year of how you felt it went from a personal standpoint, getting to know everybody, because obviously there are some personalities within the league that you had to get to know, because it is a...
I'm sorry, we can't hold in laughter there.
Well, I mean, that's why you have me on the show, because I am a personality there, but it's not a young coach-driven league right now. Some leagues are taken over by younger coaches because some of the older coaches retired. We are on the higher end of our cycle with our coaches. They're older. And we do have some personalities in our league. How did it work out for you in coming into the league?
I was welcomed with open arms, and I couldn't have asked for a better group of coaches and administrators to be a part of that. But I do think that there's something special about a more veteran seasoned crew, because the wealth of knowledge that I had to come to and say, why is it this way, or how did we get here, or what was the conversation to arrive at this decision? Is it perfect? Do we like it now? Maybe not. Is there opportunity for consideration, other models in the future, whether that be scheduling or postseason or the landscape that I'm sure we're going to talk about and what's happening in college athletics, not just college hockey right now? And so that's been tremendous. I think that I inherited a league that there was a lot of opportunity, right? There's a lot of things, no lie, and people have heard me say this before, that many things were antiquated and simple processes we could put in place to elevate. And so I think as we have a healthy group of directors at all of our institutions across our men's league and our women's league that are ready and willing to take the step forward and say, what is our new identity? And this merging between College Hockey America and Atlantic Hockey is really the first step in elevating all that we're doing.
I wanted to actually touch on the women's side, because a lot of people don't, there's still a disconnect. People don't even sometimes understand that Atlantic Hockey and College Hockey America are one.
Yeah.
But that seems like the best opportunity for growth right now is the women's side. And obviously Delaware coming in is a big positive step for women's hockey. How much growth potential is there on the women's side of this?
I think if you look at what's happening right now at PWHL, that's exploding. And in their first year, they're packing NHL buildings and having a new crop of fans that we didn't even really know existed, because we're introducing young girls and women to a sport that maybe they hadn't paid attention to or hadn't lived in a hockey hotbed before. And so I think that the partnership that we as women's commissioners have started to forge with the leadership at the PWHL, like our relationship with the folks at the NHL, has been helpful to say, how are we being strategic about assigning officials, about there's a different level of physicality in the women's game in the college space than there is in the pros, and how are we best preparing our female student athletes to go on to higher levels? Because right now there's 93% of the PWHL rosters are made up of former NCAA players.
That's a very good point. I've watched a lot of PWHL hockey up in Boston, and the physical play of the game is, I think, what's attracting a lot of fans to the game. But that's a disconnect right now between college.
Yeah, and specific to our league, I think, you know, there is this disconnect because we've been two separate entities, and our membership is not the same. You know,
right.
Derek, with representing Robert Morris, and the women's team there have membership in both of these conferences, and I think that that's an opportunity. There's more of an opportunity probably on the women's side because there's right now six, soon to be seven with Delaware and adding a team. But having the conversations about, you know, are there any schools on the men's side right now that don't have a women's team that might consider it? Or, you know, what does the shifting landscape look like as teams move conferences? Not to say anybody is, no breaking news there, but being aware of what that landscape looks like and what the future opportunities might present.
I'll then go to the other side of that conversation, the men's side. Is there any thought or potential for expansion to 11's a number, odd numbers in a lot of leagues right now. I think by next year it'll be four of the six leagues will have odd numbers. But odd can be challenging from a scheduling perspective. Is with 12, I think 12 is probably, I know the answer, 12 is preferred, but is there a 12 out there that you see?
I like symmetry. Just put that there.
I do too.
But, you know, ultimately that's a decision of our board of directors.
Yeah.
And I, as a commissioner, have to make sure that they have the most information to make informed decisions under their consideration. So we've actively gone through, you know, assessment process and had conversations and looking at institutions that are like institutions that can add value to our league, but also how can we as a league add value to them? It's truly a partnership. And so I think that, you know, in the relatively near future, that will be a conversation. Whether they take action or not, I don't know. You know, there's a large pool of independents, but there's also, again, probably more on the women than the men's side. There's a lot of institutions that are exploring adding teams and what that might do for their campus climate or enrollment.
Michelle, you mentioned the merger of the operations into one league, and with that is some marketing and branding that you've been working on. Where is that right now in that process?
Talk to me in a few weeks.
Yeah, I want to know the answers to some of these
questions,
too.
We're really close. We're just finalizing, you know, putting some, crossing some T's and dotting some I's, and I would anticipate that by late spring, early summer, that will be for public consumption and where we're moving forward, because we need to work backwards and make sure people have enough time to change over signage and buildings and jersey patches and all the things that have marks and logos and everything else. But hang tight, so a little teaser for you, but in the next couple weeks, you'll know more.
What are you most proud of in your first year?
That's a great question. I think I'm so busy doing what I do that I don't often stop to process and
this
think.
This is your opportunity to pat yourself on the back.
I think that, thanks, Derek, I think that that's something I need to work on, but always something I try to do what would be in the off season or in the summer and unplug a little bit. I think I'm probably most proud of today, when we get through this announcement and what our league is going to look like in the future. I think I'm most proud of, it's not hockey related. It's really working intentionally to be present on campuses and build relationships with the people that make this league so special, because that's what helps me understand. And I think that's how we make the game better and we elevate this for everybody.
Good answer. I really like the fact that you've taken us to more of a technology-based comparative. I love Commissioner DiGregorio, and we've had some great talks this weekend, but we took a big step with him when we took off the caps lock button on him.
Yeah. The amount of paper that I inherited is a whole other topic of conversation.
Hey, I look at a bigger picture of college hockey in general, because I think it affects your league a lot. The transfer portal, the coaches from your league that I've talked to this weekend, some of them feel, I don't know what the word is, pillaged. they're almost, sometimes they're feeling too much like a development league for the bigger programs and the higher revenue and the higher profile programs. We know that the transfer portal can't go away. It's not going away. There's been lawsuits after lawsuits. There's no way it's going to go away. But what are the conversations like among your athletic directors and among your coaches, you know, when it comes to the portal right now?
We haven't talked about this yet this week, have we?
No, not at all. Not off the record at all. So I think coming up on our meetings in Naples, that'll be obviously a big topic. And having the ability to have all of our membership and coaches and administrators around the table is really important, because each institution may have a little bit of a different lens. I was warned my first week on the job in Naples last year. I was warned, Michelle, this is a problem. And now I'm living it and understanding it firsthand in this seat in the, in the last couple days, weeks even, right? It's crazy. I think, to your point, we know that the transfer portal is not going away. Do I think it's being utilized how it was intended to be used? Absolutely not. Do I think we are at a place as a membership that, you know, so much of the decisions that we arrive at or how we have gotten here is based from a defensive position of litigation and now we have to react to something versus being strategic and being offensive with something? Absolutely. That's not the best way to do life, but, you know, we're in these intersections of time and things happen. Something has to happen. I don't have the answer on what that looks like, but I think that you are lying if you say that, you know, there isn't side conversations or maybe there's not a paper trail or things that can be proved.
Right.
But there are some things that just make you go, hmm.
Tampering.
Exactly.
That's the word. I think the NFL literally has used the word now. It almost feels like we need it in college hockey, tampering, because it feels like there's tampering going on.
I think the important part of the piece, and this is obviously a hockey-specific conversation, we have to remember that this just isn't a hockey issue, though.
No.
Right? This is universal across all sports, all divisions. Obviously, Division I probably sees it a lot more just in numbers and metrics than, you know, a Division III institution. But that said, you know, this is whatever our opinion is as hockey institutions and hockey conferences and coaches and administrators, that's one piece of the bigger pie. And so even though we may have formulated our solution or opinion, that's not to say that that's automatically going to be the solution or going to work, because it has to fit with all other sports that are supported by the NCAA and are affected by the transfer portal.
Well, we're becoming agent and advisor driven.
Yeah.
That's where it's not coach-driven, it's not administrator-driven. We're becoming driven by the advisors, driven by – and the process of recruiting has become driven that way. And that's where everybody's understanding that. And that's – I mean, when you get calls and say, hey, would you be interested in this player? He's on somebody else's roster.
Yeah.
And that those calls are happening.
It came up at State of the Game yesterday. I believe it was – maybe Steve Metcalf addressed it a little bit. I know Scott Sandlin did. But the pool of players, you have a whole big pool in the Canadian Hockey League that they're banned from playing college hockey after they finish in the CHL because of the fact that they, you know, took some meal money and that lost their amateur status. But, you know, you also might have some players that are making five figures right now in college hockey. I know Derek has his opinion. I've heard a lot of your coaches' opinions on this. It does feel like there's, in your league at least, there's a lot of support to potentially open up college hockey to CHL players. Where, as a commissioner, do you see that going?
If I had a crystal ball, I think it'll happen. I think it's how do we get from A to B is the biggest thing. There's some kinks we have to educate people on. And I've said this a lot the last couple of days, but we need to make sure the coaches and the administrators are working from the same set of facts. Had a conversation with a coach this week, not in our league, and it, as a former athletic director, thinking like an administrator to say, well, all of a sudden, if you have these international students here and we, you know, talk about in parallel this professionalism model and or amateurism model and what might happen there and benefits related to things, students now need work visas potentially. And, you know, you're an employee, and employment and contract law looks a lot different than when you're at will playing on a scholarship and
right.
want to be there for XYZ reason. You know, we are in a non-sports related lens. You know, many of our institutions of higher education in this country that support hockey and don't support hockey are enrollment driven. They use sports to put people in their classrooms, and that's the business that they're in. That opens a new population of people that may be driven to an institution that you know, president or university leadership would say, yeah, that's great. We want that. But may sound great in this answer in this moment, but what are the unintended or the intended consequences of that down the road that we might not be thinking of? So let's holistically look at this before so we can make an informed decision.
Michelle, looking forward for Atlantic Hockey and CHA, Atlantic Hockey in particular was created more as a cost containment league.
That's a naughty word, Ed. We don't talk about that word anymore.
No. That's in the past.
Yeah,
that's
no, I've heard, but I don't know anything about that.
Right. So
that's a dirty word
but,
in our league.
But that's no longer the case, as it's gone from a limited number of scholarships to the full complement of 18. And I think this was the fourth season or fifth season at 18, something
fourth.
Like that, fourth. Where do you see the league going? Obviously, it has made great strides in competitiveness on the national landscape. Is that something that you can see continuing to progress?
And I'm going to my question, piggyback on that, is what are you most proud of the league? A two-part on that one.
Okay, there you go.
I'm going to answer that in the reverse order. I think that I am most proud of our administrators that are willing to listen and consider new, whether it's great earth-breaking or let's be on the head of the curve, because my perception of this league or things that I've picked up along the way is things have been very reactionary. Again, we talked about that in decision-making over here. We talked about the transfer portal, right, that there's been nothing to say how are we being strategic and who we are and telling our story, right? So there's been a lot of myth-busting. People still think in, you know, oh, Atlantic, they don't, not full scholarships or,
right.
You know,
cost containment.
Bush League hockey, right? It's not. It's
right.
Not. And so I think that we have a really great group of administrators that are willing to listen, that if laid out, you know, the pluses and minuses and the value proposition to say, hey, let's invest in new technology and how are we best, you know, informing them of options and what that looks like. You know, our streaming deal is up this year. What are we going to be doing with that again, you know, going forward here in the near future? How are we, again, telling our story? And now that we have this new pool of institutions on the women's side that support women's hockey and now as one entity, how do we leverage their brands and their resources as well? I think that's a tremendous opportunity.
I also want to use the opportunity before we wrap up to give a plug for the folks in your front office, Todd Bell and Gino Binda, who have been terrific to work with. And everybody I talked to has just been really excited about the job Gino has done in his first year on the job.
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't really know Gino before. Obviously, I had the opportunity to interact with his dad a little bit in the crossover before he had retired when Bobby D retired at the same time. You know, and I think people are well aware, right? It's a little bit of an old boys club. And I think sometimes there's concern about, you know, our habits taught and are you the same as what your dad is? And look, they've been doing it a long time. And Gino, I think, is really got a bright opportunity and future ahead of him. He works really hard as a former on-ice official that's just gotten off the ice in recent years. He's really knowledgeable. I think as he and I work together, it's really interesting because I'll say, help me understand what you see here and what I see and the points of emphasis as we're breaking down film and play or talking to a coach about why wasn't this called or why does this merit supplemental discipline or what does that look like? And so I've been really pleased with Gino and happy, and I think he's been a good outlet for coaches to say, hey, and there's been times where we screw up, right? Or and we'll say that. We're like, yep, we missed that. Or that should, yep, you're right. That should have been a call. But you know what? Sometimes nobody has a rebuttal to that because we're like, thank you, right? It doesn't change the outcome, but that's half the battle.
And that's all that we want as coaches at times. And we at times we didn't get that.
Yeah.
There was always something else. And yes, I told him that the other day. He's done an outstanding job. He once again has brought technology and video and things like that we hadn't had before.
Yeah, it goes back to let's work from the same set of facts. But I think it's also, and coaches and administrators have been really patient with us because we're learning how to work together. I'm learning how to do this job. He's learning how to do that job. And so all we can do is hustle and grind and give you our best effort, but ask for a little patience and guidance too because there's still a learning curve on our end.
Once again, Michelle, your favorite coach?
Oh.
Still right now?
Yeah, right next to me.
How can anybody not say Rick Gawkin? Let's go. Come on. You've already renewed my contract.
I know. Well, Michelle Morgan, we appreciate your joining us. Congratulations on year number one. We look forward to working with you plenty in the future, and obviously enjoy the full circle effect of Twin Cities hockey for
you
yourself
too.
This
tonight.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with more of USCHO Live in just a moment. Welcome back to USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Ed Trefsker with Jim Connolly and Derek Schooley. And Jim, we continue, we touched a little bit on women's hockey in our discussion with CHA and Atlantic Hockey Commissioner Michelle Morgan, but we're going to spend the next 20 minutes or so really focusing on that.
Yeah, I'm really pleased to be joined by a new friend in the college hockey world, the pretty much the biggest new hire in college hockey, Sadie Lundquist, who has now heading at is heading up the women's side of College Hockey Inc. Welcome to College Hockey. It's great to have you as an administrator in this game. But what's it been like this first half year, really, kind of not even a full year here under your belt?
Well, first, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, taking a slice of the men's weekend to focus on women's sports. So I certainly appreciate that. But it's been incredible. I think I'm about 4 months in or so, and a bit of a whirlwind coming in at the timing that I did. But jumping back into the world of college hockey has just been a blessing. It's been so much fun. It's rejuvenated my passion for hockey, if you will. I was with the Wild for about 8 years right out of college, and so I focused a lot on professional hockey, and now to be back in the world that shaped so much of who I am, college hockey certainly shaped me as a person and an athlete. So I'm excited to give back and hopefully continue growing the game. So
try to explain to people that maybe don't know. You know, I think people understand what College Hockey Inc. is. They've known the marketing portion of it. Trying to explain to men's, young boys, teenagers, how to keep your eligibility. For the women's side, it's not exactly the same role. You know, you're not worried about girls signing major junior contracts or something like that. You have a different perspective and a different role. Tell people what you're focused on right now.
Yeah, this is a great question, and I hope my mom is listening because she has no idea what I do. She doesn't know how to explain what I do. So I hope you're out there listening. But to your point, the men's side is so much focusing on keeping their eligibility. And the women's side, the best path forward for the elite athletes and elite hockey players is to go with NCAA. So our goal is not to sway people there. They're already there, the best athletes. I was just watching USA and the IIHF Women's Worlds. Both Team Canada and Team USA are 100% NCAA athletes, either former or present. So our goal is just to continue growing it, growing the prospect pool and making sure young girls know how to play college hockey, growing the platform of women's currently. You know, there's some incredible storylines in schools, and just making sure that the audience is bigger, broader, and more engaged. And then, you know, with the PWHL now, growing that opportunity, being that bridge between, it doesn't stop in college. Now you have a professional league. I shouldn't say now. I did play in the NWHL. So there's a new rejuvenated league for women to play in, and it's going to be a huge, huge opportunity for national-level players and for college players to continue playing at an even higher level. So
you mentioned PWHL. Mm-hmm. I think anybody that was not buried in the sand for the last month has watch this women's basketball tournament, the highest rated NCAA tournament in history for the women's side. There is a new opportunity to continue to just not hockey alone, every women's sport. I'm looking in back of us, we see NCAA softballs on the TV right now, and the women's Frozen Four had an unbelievable championship game this year. Obviously, the storylines out of South Carolina and Iowa in the women's basketball championship. What do you see as the future or the opportunity that's in front of us now
for the future of women's sports.
You're spot on. It's so funny. I keep bringing up Caitlin Clark and Iowa basketball, and you kind of get some scoffs, but they're really setting the stage for women's sports. It's not just women's basketball.
Right.
It's how are we using this momentum? And I feel like there is the momentum and the support for women's sports and women's hockey feels different right now. It really does. It feels like people are engaged, not just to say, oh, I supported them, I bought tickets. People are going and saying, this is really good hockey, and this is really good athletics. Not women's hockey, not women's basketball. This is really good athletics. So we are trying to, I don't want to say ride the coattails of that, because women's hockey has been on the up and up, but certainly take the momentum that they've built and continue to push the product. If you want to watch the best hockey, there you can go to an NCAA game and see three quarters of the world's roster playing in a stadium of 2,000 people. Or 2,000 seats, and have really, really intimate experiences with the best hockey that women's hockey has to offer. So,
well, first of all, Jason and Sean felt a little left out because you took their spot.
I was going to say, I feel so bad.
You took their spot,
and
they basically said that you have a lot of big shoes to fill, and you've done a great job filling them. So far. You're way more interesting than them.
I don't know about that, Jason.
Good job so far. Now we're getting to the hard stuff.
Oh, yeah.
What's next? What's the biggest thing you want to try to accomplish for women's hockey? Obviously, eligibility in the men's side. You know, Mike works on the growth of the game, trying to new teams and feasibility studies.
Yep.
What is the biggest thing that you see moving forward in the women's game? And I've got a daughter that plays college hockey. I watch a lot of games. What's the biggest thing you see moving forward for...
I feel like break that into two parts. One, it's with Mike growing the game, getting more campuses and colleges to support women's hockey. Obviously, Michigan has been a hot ticket item as of right now.
Well, if you did that, you might as well just retire after that one.
I know, right? There's so many people pushing that. So I think that in the current landscape, growing that, getting the Michigan schools on board, getting more opportunities for girls to play, but then also filling the bottom of the funnel, making sure that there's a lot of young 5- and 6-year-old girls who are coming up and having opportunities to play. We can have 100 college teams, but we got to make sure that we're really fulfilling that bottom of the funnel. So that's where I really want to focus, is how are we growing the game, exposing the game, getting more 5- and 6-year-olds playing so that as they grow up, they, aspire to play in the Michigans, hopefully soon to come, and so that they, have the opportunities tenfold from what I had.
Yeah, grassroots. I have a young 11-year-old daughter that plays girls hockey, and grassroots does feel like it is an issue. There's a point where you just kind of have to separate away from the boys. I mean, when I was coming up, and our high school boys team had one girl on it, because she had no opportunity to play. There are opportunities, more opportunities now on the balancing out, but does that even have to get a little larger? I'm in Massachusetts,
definitely.
And we don't see one high school, like you have three different towns that have to combine to put one team together. That's where I think the grassroots of this game needs to grow.
Absolutely agree. And, we've kind of done it to ourselves a little bit in the hockey world. It's already a niche sport. We need to make it more accessible, more affordable in certain areas. And, I don't always want to come back to Minnesota, but the grassroots efforts that Minnesota makes it's not going to work everywhere, but it is a model to be sought after and learned from, I think, in certain areas. So, I grew up, I played boys for a little bit, but then I went to girls, and I played with the same girls from age 8 until I graduated high school. And I think the beauty of it is some of those girls I played with, their goals were just to be the best high school player. It wasn't plucking the best 3 players and putting them on some team where they're staying, etch every which way and on flights and, staying in hotels every weekend. Not to say that that isn't what some girls have to do. I'm certainly acknowledging that, but there was I got to play in front of my friends, in front of my school, in front of my teachers. I got to play for my community. And I want that for more girls. I just wish that we could really, embody that in other communities. And it's a big ask. I don't know that Mike, myself, Jason, and Sean can tackle all of those things at once. But
in the whole country.
I think if we can start to build that up and grow that bottom of the funnel and grassroots efforts for girls hockey, it's going to pay dividends. And it's going to take time, but 5, 10, 15 years down the road, it'll pay dividends.
And as that grows, you're going to need more college programs out there, too. And that's been a big part of College Hockey, Inc. on the men's side, adding programs. And what do you have in the works working with universities maybe to add, I don't want to lead too much on this, but adding a women's program where there's traditionally only been a men's program, especially in a great hockey state that might have no women's programs.
That's a big part of what we're going to be doing. It's a huge opportunity for us on the College Hockey Inc. side. You know, everything I want to be met with opportunity, right? Like, that's the thing we keep saying, opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. I don't want it to be like a, well, why don't you have that? It's a, what can we do for women's hockey, and how can this help your campus? This isn't, you know, just handing them out because you feel bad for women's hockey. We have an incredible sport. It's going to bring great athletes, great students, great alumni to your campus. It's going to build a better culture on your campus. So we have some schools in the hopper. I'm sure some folks have seen the Michigan headlines.
Yep.
You know, those are areas that we're focusing on. So we're excited for Delaware. You know, that's been a big thing, especially with them just adding women's hockey. That's a huge testament to Delaware and the you know, what they're putting into their women's program. They want to come in and they want to win. They just don't want to have a team.
Right.
They want to win, which is super cool to see. So, it's just super exciting. There's campuses and colleges that are interested. So,
and I've seen a growth on the fan side, too. I broadcast some women's games alongside the men's games at RIT, and they've been averaging about 600 attendance at games, which, you know, is up from like 100 a few years ago. And it's not just like a women-specific fan base. The fans of hockey are there showing up to those games. And that's particularly good when sometimes those are early games on a Friday or something like that to get that attendance. I really hope we can see more of that grow across the sport.
I think so, too. It's how do we get that fan in once? I feel like I'm sitting in good company. Hockey is the best sport to watch live. I truly believe that. I love golf. I love football. It is the best sport to watch live. And it's just getting those fans into that one game and getting them hooked. I was in Utica last weekend for the preliminaries of the world.
Yeah.
And there were so many fans there that were just from Utica.
Great atmosphere.
They
great
didn't play hockey.
There, yeah.
Their kids didn't play hockey. They were just in the city and said, we wanted to watch hockey. And they were blown away at the product. And you know those folks are going to come back again and again. And they're going to find a college team to latch on to and maybe a PWHL team. So it's that whole ecosystem of we just got to get them into one game. We'll see what they've been missing, and it'll help grow that.
We had Jeff Shulman on earlier, the chair of the men's Division I committee. And I asked him, there's a lot of great teams that don't make the tournament every year, and I asked him about expansion. Men's does not feel like it's poised for expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Women's just went from 8 to 11, but do you feel that this tournament is poised to maybe expand? I know the NCAA does all these margins and ratios, and you have to have a certain number, but it feels like this could go to 12 or maybe even a 16-team tournament.
I would at least like to see it go to 12, hopefully with adding these new teams. To your point, it's that whole ratio and percentage of teams such, I understand, but if we could get that 12th team, it would just make it feel a little bit more legitimate. Right now, it's kind of interesting. You know, Ohio State is the top seed, but they're the only team that doesn't know who their first opponent is. So that entire week that they're preparing, it's a this or that. So I would love to see it expand. I think, again, going back to the basketball thing, how do we kind of build off that momentum and try to draw similarities to build up this tournament? And even right now, I mean, I'm bummed as a Minnesotan that there are no Minnesota fans here.
There's a lot of Minnesota fans there. Let's get around.
No Minnesota teams here, and I'm so proud to be in Minnesota and see how many random high school jerseys and youth jerseys there are supporting a tournament that had no Minnesota teams.
And Fighting Sioux fans.
I didn't bring that up for a reason. They ended half my college season. The Twins punished me in college.
I will stay on the topic of the tournament. The Frozen Four this year in Durham, one of the biggest crowds they've ever had at that event. That seems like another big opportunity to grow this women's games, to keep putting those events in great cities.
Yes. New Hampshire, Durham, they did a phenomenal job. It was incredible. Even the Patty Kaz, the way they have now shifted that ceremony a little bit, it was super engaging. But they were an incredible host city. And you kind of knew it. I know they've hosted in the past, but it does seem like it's elevated every year. And, you know, it's in Minnesota next year, so they set a high expectation for Minnesota to exceed. But it was great. I had never been to Durham. I never was fortunate enough to play against New Hampshire in college. But the city was great. The school was great. The hosting, everything was incredible. So I'm excited. I'm excited for Minnesota next year, see what they can do to up the ante a little bit.
There's one question I meant to ask, and I forgot to. So I'll go back to it. The international player in women's college hockey, we saw it on the men's side. I think we got the stat. It went from 30 to 180 in about 3 or 4 years. I see a lot of Hockey East women's teams, a lot of European players, some Canadian players.
the international side seems like a big opportunity as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Clarkson had, I think, 22 Canadians on it. Do we consider them international?
They walk across
the
street
exactly,
and they're in Canada.
Right. I don't know if we're considering that international, but the Women's World is on right now. And like I said, Team USA, Team Canada are 100% NCAA. And then you're seeing kind of that next tier of teams, Finland, Sweden, Denmark. There's a larger growing presence of NCAA hockey. You know, top 9, 10, 11 of their current or former players were NCAA. So, I mean, it's the best hockey. If you want to play the best hockey out of high school, that is where kids are going to go. And the initiative that Mike and I want to accomplish is to build better relationships with IIHFs of other countries, so that it isn't as daunting for a kid from Sweden to come play hockey. You can kind of see, like, St. Cloud has figured out, I think they've got 5 or 6 Swedes. Kind of like, you can get one, they come, they see what it's like, they realize the hockey's good, and then they convince that next peer, that next friend to come. So we want to build that relationship and make sure that if there are girls in Europe who want to play college hockey, they know what they're getting themselves into, they know how to play, and it's just going to make hockey better, right? It's just going to grow the game. The worlds are going to be more competitive. You're going to see NCAA grow. You're going to see PWHL grow. It's a whole ecosystem, and opportunities for one are opportunities for the other.
Well, Sadie Lundquist, welcome to the college hockey family. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
As a former player, you've already been here, but now you're in the true family. We'll see you every Frozen Four. We look forward to that and all the great work you're doing at College Hockey Inc. So welcome, and thanks for your time today.
No, thank you so much for having me. I sincerely appreciate all three of you.
Tell Sean and Jason you're much better.
Oh, my gosh. I wish I could, but those three are so incredible. And it's funny, with Mike Knee, I know more about the 1987 Twins than I ever thought I could. So they're just three incredible guys. I'm super fortunate to have them as co-workers.
Well, thanks for your time again. Enjoy the game tonight.
Thank you so much, guys.
We'll be back in a moment with Andrew Mahoney from the Boston Globe to preview tonight's championship game here on USCHO Live. Welcome back to USCHO Live Saturday at the 2024 Frozen Four in St. Paul. I'm Ed Trefsker alongside Jim Connolly and Derek Schooley, and we also bring back Andrew Mahoney from the Boston Globe to preview tonight's game between Boston College and Denver.
Well, we were all half right.
That's right.
I was too chicken. We talked about this yesterday. I was too chicken. I kept saying I wanted to pick an upset.
Yeah.
And we're half right. We all said BUBC. Now here we are. Where are we going to go with this one?
And it did feel like if there was going to be an upset, it would be Denver. You know,
it's easy to say that now.
No,
right?
But I wasn't picking them. But I thought Denver was the more likely of the two to win. I just, again, you know, I guess we got to be cautious after what happened the other day. But I don't see Denver, again, scoring just 2 goals in being able to win a game like they've done for the last 3 times. I mean, they've scored 4 goals in 3 tournament games in regulation, and here they are in the championship game.
We talked about it in our preview that Jimmy and I did out by the Herb Brooks statue. We talked about it in the first segment today. We really believe, at least we were talking about it, that I say if BC gets to 3, they win. Jimmy says 4. Ed, what does BC have to get to it for you to win?
I think 3 could do it.
because I don't know if it's a track meet, BC wins, Denver's got to keep it low scoring again.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, we're talking about how some of these powerhouse teams in the past have come up short, and there's, when you look at them, there's always sort of some sort of fatal flaw. A lot of times it's in net. That's not the case with BC. You can't say that about Fowler. So, yeah, I think the way Denver hasn't been able to score much lately, if BC gets three, I think Fowler is going to be able to keep them under, and, you know, BC's bringing the trophy back to Boston.
What stood out to you about Boston College the other day? Obviously, that the kid line, the freshman line, you know, looked really good, and the right players scored, the stars scored in the big game. But what else stood out to you about that team?
Well, I think, honestly, that was the biggest thing, because through this postseason, it feels like they've had to count on the veterans. You know, Jack Malone has had to come up big to them, Ambrosio. And it almost seemed like the young guys, not that they were caught up in the moment. I mean, Leonard has produced all along, but, you know, maybe Perot and Smith, it felt like at times maybe, I don't know if they were wearing down or if the game was just a little bit too physical for them at this stage of their careers. But to see them get untracked, I thought that was the biggest thing. And then, you know, it was a 4-0 game. It was a clear win for BC, but Michigan had some chances,
especially early on.
Yeah, and Fowler was not letting them in. Just like you said, early on, and then later in the game, Fowler was not going to let them back in the game. So, and then just the way they were able to just lock that down. You know, Greg Brown talked about it afterwards. You know, sending the puck up along the boards, like just content to just, you know, almost like just running the clock out, like the old Dean Smith, four corners in basketball. Like it was impressive.
Since we're all west of the Mississippi, or east of the Mississippi, none of us are west of the Mississippi here. I'm going to throw this out, and we briefly touched on it at the end of the first segment. What's their strength? I don't know if they've got strength in goal. I don't know if they've got the strength in the offense. What's the strength of Denver right now? So we don't say there's an Eastern bias here on this final panel. What's Denver's strength, and how did they go about winning this game? And I'm throwing that out to the group.
You're saying advantage. Really.
Advantage, yeah. What's their advantage in tonight's game?
I the only thing I would say is experience. You know, they won the title 2 years ago. This is a beast.
But only nine players from that team.
That's
still
true.
Here, you know,
that's
it's
true.
It's so many new faces in that lineup.
But as a, I don't know if we call them organization, as a program, you know, this coaches.
A franchise, if you're Barry Melrose.
There you go. certainly, you know, Brownie went through this as an assistant coach with Jerry York. But, you know, this is sort of this is something that Denver's been used to for the last few years. But your point is well taken, Jim. It's not the same roster as it was from 2 years ago. It almost feels a little bit, though, too, like last year, where I think everyone outside the Big Ten was dreading an all-Big Ten final. And then here comes Quinnipiac knocking, you know, Michigan and Minnesota off to win the whole thing. This year, you feel like people outside of Hockey East and outside of Boston were like, are we really going to have an all-Boston final? And then, you know, Denver comes out, knocks out BU. Are they going to, you know, can they pull it off and upset BC now?
So I'm going to toss one in here on this, and this is not a reflection of Greg Brown at all, but I think maybe the advantage is going to be how David Carl has them prepared and what their strategy and what their game plan is, because he's in the position of having to be the coach that has to come up with a way to really stymie that potent Boston College offense. And they've learned some defense down the stretch. We talked about that midseason. They said, hey, we're the 40th team in defense, and they've shown it. And you know, Jacob Fowler's Jacob Fowler, but Matt Davis has been equal to that challenge, if not better, in these three tournament games. So maybe it just comes down to game plan and execution, because they're not going to be able to out-star power them.
And, you know, they seem pretty loose. It's an interesting approach where it's like, we're not going to practice. We're not even going to bring the guys into the arena yesterday. You can talk to all our scratches at the press conference, and, you know, I guess that's apparently what they did 2 weeks ago in Springfield, too. And so they're confident in that approach. And I would agree with that. As you said, it's not to take anything away from Greg Brown, but this is only his second year as head coach. There's a track record there with David Carl that can't be discounted.
And I'll give you the stat that I think I pulled yesterday. Since over the last 28 days, which covers the conference championships, the conference semifinals, finals in the NCHC. It covers the regional, it covers the Frozen Four. Denver has the number one defense in the country, just 1.46 goals in that time allowed per game. That, you feel you've got the two best offenses here tonight, but I still think the story of this game might be defense.
Yeah, and I still think BC can hold up in that. That's not the game they want to play. And if it is the game that's played that way, it's certainly going to be very competitive, obviously. But, yeah, they've certainly come up with something. It's pretty impressive to be able to do that mid-season. Usually at some point you are what you are.
Right.
And they've been able to turn it around. And, I think they really have a good shot today. I still like BC, but, I'm certainly not going to count Denver and say this is going to be a walkover.
I want to switch gears a little bit. Last night, Macklin Celebrini wins the Hobey Baker Award. Obviously did not win a national championship. I know you probably don't have any insight on this. He's not even drafted yet, but do you think we see Macklin Celebrini in Boston again?
I think it's going to depend on whoever ends up with the number one pick. It'll be interesting with San Jose, right, if they end up with the pick. I mean, they signed Colin Graf. They already have Will Smith. I mean, that would be kind of an interesting summer for them if they end up with Celebrini.
And there's some good BU roots there.
just a couple,
just
right?
The front office,
yeah.
behind the
coach.
Bench.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But maybe they might do a favor.
Well,
if Jay Pandolfo were to make that phone call and say, hey, you took this kid number one overall, but can we have him for one more year? I don't know if that's the way it works in the NHL.
Right, and it's for some reason they deem he isn't ready. I mean, I don't know how that works if he goes down to the AHL where he's only 18. And,
can't do it.
Yeah, so
can't do it. Yeah, so, he would have to go back. He have to go to Major Junior.
Right. So I don't. That is a consideration. People I've talked to say he's ready. Whether or not he will go. I think it probably depends on the organization.
Didn't get on the score sheet on Thursday night, but he still was a pretty dominant player out there.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't for a lack of good looks. There was a couple of clanks, a couple of really good saves. You couldn't really fault him there, that's for sure.
We have, Ed, I don't know if you have the money line or the...
I do.
The over-under up, but last I had seen...
We were so wrong last week.
I know,
why are we even going there?
I'm surprised you guys had me back. I said hammer the over on both of them. So
We didn't even hit the over in the combined game.
No. That's right.
So right now the money line is Denver plus 220 and BC minus 298. Over-under is 6, and it's shading towards the under.
Shading towards the under, it's 6, despite the fact that these two teams, if you add their combined goals per game, is about almost 10.
Yeah, right.
So it's an understanding that things change in these tournament games. They really do. And listen, we saw Denver win a championship a couple of years ago where it was a 1-0 game heading to the third, if I remember right. And next thing, it's a 6-goal game.
Yeah.
How about this as part of it? Probably going to see fewer power play opportunities in these tournament games. That probably has something to do with it. I don't know what the tendencies might be of the crew working tonight.
ECAC crew, I haven't seen any of these guys work an NCAA game this year.
We saw
them last year in the tournament. Didn't call a ton. So.
Right, and I don't think anybody's going to call a ton. I mean, we saw the other night between Denver and BU, Denver not
a no-hitter.
No power play opportunities for BU. You could go back on that one and say, well, let's give Denver a couple and a couple more to BU or something like that. But I expect it's going to be something along those lines where they're not going
to
call a lot.
I talked to the refs last night, and they said, okay, we could have given BU 2 power plays, but then we would have had to give Denver 7. I mean, that's because if we wanted to go ticky-tack, we could have went 2-7.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're going to see probably, if you're going to go over-under on power plays, I think you're going to go under 5 tonight.
Well, and I think in terms of goals, over-under, I mean, if you have a close game but BC's only up by 1, Denver's going to pull the goalie. And you got those snipers out there going after an open net, and then that could get, out of hand in a hurry, too.
I was waiting for that the other night because the in-game over-under was 4.5.
Yeah.
And I said,
it was 1-0 at that point. BC pops the 2. I said, oh, it's going over.
Yeah.
But then you never get the pulled goalie situation because once it gets to 4, Michigan's not going to make it worse.
And like I said, you know, BC was very content to just keep on clearing the puck out of the zone, not icing it, just keeping the clock moving, having short shifts, you know, just keeping everybody loose. And
easy pucks off the wall and right up.
Yeah.
So do we start prediction time here?
We got 5 minutes left, and hey, this season's over.
Ed, you want to start?
Okay. Yeah, I guess I'll start.
You know what? I went last time, and I was soft. I went.
You were a hedger.
I was all over the place. Yeah. I'll go 4-2 BC.
Oh, see, now that was what I was going to
say.
Oh, yeah. But that 4 is an empty netter. And then,
ooh, you think it's that close of a game?
And then it's a push. And then it's a push on the over/under.
All right, I'll say. I'm along that line. You know, you're talking 3-2 earlier, and then I'll say BC pumps in a couple of empty netters, 5-2 BC.
5-2. Ed, are you sticking with 4-2?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
See, I want to say 5-1 Boston College.
Oh.
Aren't you going to say Quinnipiac 3-2 in overtime?
That would be the best way to go.
Well, if you do that, if we go that way, if you pick 5-1, we just guaranteed a Denver win.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, well, sorry, Boston College fans. I love you out there, but I'm picking you tonight.
are you seeing 5-1, though, with some empty netters there, or are you actually
thinking? Maybe one,
Maybe
you get a 4-1 game. They throw one down into an empty net. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I really feel like this is going to go a little bit, and I'm not trying to put a hex on the game, but if this team feels a little bit like the 2010 team that – it was a close game, 1-0 headed into the third, but then you break it open and 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, next to the 5-0 final. I'll give Denver the credit they're going to score a goal, but I'm going to go 5-1 Boston College.
I'm going to go where it's not.
And I wouldn't touch the over/under.
It's not going to go again. It's not going to be a very good game. I'm going to think. I'm going to say even if I go 4-2, I'm going to go late 4-2. It's 4-0. They sneak into a 4-2 somehow.
Okay, I'll go with that too.
Interesting.
It has been a great year. Andrew, you've become a perennial guest in this now.
I
this
appreciate
broadcast.
It. Thank you to the Boston teams or the New England teams that find a way into this tournament.
It certainly helps.
I tried to get rid of you this morning, though, too. We're all wrong. I tried to fire myself. They wouldn't let me go.
We will wrap up one more time at the end of this season after Naples. Derek, Ed, and I will return for a special Monday edition.
Probably
on a Wednesday. But that'll be something to look forward to. I want to take the opportunity here to thank all the people here at Tom Reed's. They have been fantastic. Kathy, Justin, Tom Reed himself. Unfortunately, he's never here because he's traveling with the Wild. Because they're always sent out of town this week. But this place is an unreal bar. It is really starting to get jammed up in here. Obviously, Neil Broughton is back.
A great half-pound hamburger.
A good half-pound hamburger. I didn't have it, but I'll take your word for that. Ed, Derek, any closing thoughts on this season?
Unbelievable third year with me and you guys. I think
if you say so yourself.
No, I'm thanking you for a great year.
We have a lot of fun. Certainly changes the dynamic of Ed and I's boring podcast.
Well, I mean, I think it was different for me this year to be able to do this while coaching.
Right.
And I think I appreciate everybody who stopped and said they listen, and that makes us feel good. It's why I keep doing this. It's why you guys keep doing this when people say kind words about our podcast, and it's just not your relatives and my mom and dad listening and Steve Metcalf. So we appreciate everybody out there listening.
Ed, any closing thoughts?
No, I don't have anything to add to that, except I think this has been a really special year for college hockey. The stories have been great. The hockey's been great. Fan enthusiasm is back. What was the number, 3.9 million attendance at college hockey games that
was thrown out? And I think they said 72% of overall capacity at all arenas this entire season. And we saw that in the NCAA regional, 71.2% capacity. That's a real number. And this, you can see that this game continues to grow. The TV ratings are getting
higher and higher every year. You know, I think it's a lot of that. There's some really good broadcasts out there as well. That helps. But the product's great. It's a great product. I loved hearing from people talk about the women's game, too, and how that continues to grow. So college hockey, as they said yesterday, I was waiting for somebody to say the State of the Union is strong at the State of the Game speech. But they didn't get that far, but you knew leaving there that people are pretty confident that this is in really good hands.
But there's changes coming.
There will be. There will be.
At least we're walking out of here not scared of the Big Ten. as we did in Tampa last year.
Yep.
Everybody was terrified of the big, bad Big Ten.
Yep.
And with that, we're just about out of time. Thanks for tuning in. For Derek Schooley, for Jim Connolly, also for Andrew Mahoney, I'm Ed Trebsker, and this has been USCHO Live.